Hello, and welcome to A Good Science Read, where we discuss science books written for the general public. I'm Professor Frances Ashcroft, and my guest today is Professor Paul Smith, Director of the Oxford Museum of Natural History. He is also Professor of Natural History at the University of Oxford and a Fellow of Kellogg College, Oxford. Paul is both a geologist and a paleontologist whose research focuses on the origin of vertebrates, that is, animals with backbones. He has worked extensively in the Arctic, and in 2017 he was awarded the Polar Medal for outstanding achievements in the field of polar research. The book he has chosen is Wonderful Life, The Burgess Shale and the History of Nature by Stephen Jay Gould. It focuses on the weird and wonderful fossils found in the Burgess Shale in the Canadian Rockies, their discovery and their re-evaluation many years later. The book won the Royal Society Science Book Prize in 1991. Paul, what is the Burgess Shale and why is it so important?
Well, normally when we find fossils, we tend to think of fossils that have hard parts, shells like ammonites, or a vertebrate skeleton. The thing about the Burgess Shale is that it's what paleontologists call a case of exceptional preservation, where the soft tissues are preserved, the ones that easily decay. And that's normally due to bacterial reactions shortly after death, but it gives us a lot more anatomical information to play with.
Have you ever been there?
I haven't been to the... I've been to the foot of the hill, and I know that part of the Rockies a little. But my experience with what we call more generally Burgess Shale-style fossils has been up in the far north of Greenland at a place called Sirius Passet.
Yes, because I gather that although the Burgess Shale was probably the first site to be discovered, there are quite a few other sites subsequently found. Is that right?
That's right. It's the first and by far the best known and the longest collected. It's been collected on and off since the early 1900s. For a long time, it was thought to be right down at the origin of animals, but we have found a couple of localities that go much deeper in time. And two in particular have begun to yield a lot of information, similar to the Burgess Shale, but slightly older and slightly down towards the origin of animals. One is Sirius Passet in North Greenland, and the other one, coincidentally found in the same month, Chengjiang in southern China.
Oh, that's really exciting. So did you enjoy the book? Did you find it an easy read? Because, I mean, you picked it, but I have to confess I found it a tough read. I didn't think that it flowed for me anyway, and I kept putting it down and picking it up. I found the style was really rather dense and in places, there were too many words. It was rather flowery at times and repetitive. And the other problem was he assumed quite a bit of knowledge and he defined 20 different terms to describe arthropod anatomy, which he said were essential to know. And he included references to original papers. I suppose in my view, I found it more like a scientific review rather than something that was written for the lay public. But on the plus side, he had lots of diagrams and drawings, which were wonderful because they were these weird creatures.
Yeah, he had a particular style, it's fair to say. And he started writing more popular science in the magazine Natural History. And he churned out essay after essay after essay. And they all have that very familiar style, slightly Baroque writing style, with literary and other cultural allusions sprinkled very heavily through the text. And I noticed one section where he was introducing a new term, contingency. And in that short section, those short few paragraphs, he references Newton, General Custer, the Civil War, Tolstoy, Ruth Rendell, Stephen King, Vonnegut, Back to the Future, the film, Galileo, and of course Darwin. And that necessarily makes the text very dense. So it is sometimes hard to read. But at the same time, he certainly had an audience. They were extremely popular in that period of time.
Well, of course, he won the prize for it. So it was certainly thought very well of at the time. And I'm sure it would appeal to people who are really interested in fossils. But I just thought there was a little bit too much academic detail, perhaps?
He tries to show off a little bit too much at times, I think.
I wondered whether he'd actually written, trying to write maybe, for both the lay audience and for his contemporary scientists.
Yeah, he maybe does sit on the fence in that regard. It was shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize in 1989, I think, or 1990. So I think it's important for two reasons as a book. One is that, you know, when I was a young scientist, the only available popular accounts of paleontology were really about dinosaurs, and it opened up this much deeper time perspective on paleontology. And whereas at one time when students came through, they wanted to do dinosaurs because that's what they'd read about as kids and as teenagers, we began to see another group coming through who'd been inspired by Wonderful Life.
Well, I have to say I was inspired as well, even though I'm criticising it here. It actually stimulated me to go and look at the fossils in the University Museum, and which you have there, which was very exciting to me, and also to look them up online.
Yeah, and it's for that reason that I think he really drew in an audience. It was important for technical reasons as well, I think, and that's maybe where that divided audience comes in, because it has driven that field of research for well over 30 years now. If you look at the profile of academic citations, they've been more or less constant for more than 20 years, 25 years now. It's accrued a very large number of citations, except that everything we know in that book now is wrong, but it has still driven the field.
That's what I found completely fascinating. Because, well, if we start at the beginning, the Burgess Shale was discovered back in 1909 or something, wasn't it, by this guy called Walcott?
Charles Doolittle Walcott.
Wonderful name, Doolittle. But he didn't do little, did he? He did a lot, except that he collected all of these fossils. How many is it? 70,000 or something in the Smithsonian Museum. But he didn't actually do a great deal with them because he had so little time. He seemed to be tied down by administration.
He was an academic administrator by that time. He had been a survey geologist, so he was a very fine scientist. But like many of us, he'd gone down the path of academic administration and got more and more bogged down by it. And he tried to get away for summer field work. I can sympathise with that aspect. But then he had very little time when he was back in the institution. He was running the whole Smithsonian by this time. So he really got the ball rolling, but it was a very cursory study in those early days.
And what Gould argues is that he sort of shoehorned the animals which he identified. He put them into a standard traditional classification of animals, in particular phyla.
I think Gould is really hard on Walcott. You know, he was operating within the standards and the principles of his time, and he was doing good science. And that habit of shoehorning goes on much after Walcott. It was still prevalent in the 50s, 60s, into the 70s. So we shouldn't judge him too harshly.
And he wasn't entirely wrong, was he?
Well, no. And in the end, Gould proposes a really radical reinterpretation of how we should interpret these fossils. But in a slightly different way, we've come back more to being in line with thinking what Walcott thought. I think how we interpret those fossils now would not be entirely unfamiliar to Walcott.
And actually, it's not his own work on the Burgess Shale fossils that Gould is describing. He's really describing the work of Simon Conway Morris, isn't he? And colleagues.
Much more than just Simon. It was a triumvirate, and even broader than that as a research team. The research team was led by Harry Whittington at Cambridge, who had been at Harvard. And he brought in the same starting month, two quite outstanding PhD students, Simon Conway Morris and Derek Briggs. And it was very much that triumvirate that really drove on Burgess Shale research. But now that has cascaded through into all sorts of other avenues of paleontology. I think it's probably been the most influential research project in terms of shaping the next 30 years that have occurred in my lifetime anyway.
And is the story that he tells true about Simon having the bright idea of going and searching all the specimens in the Smithsonian Museum and picking out the ones which were the weirdest, the most strange?
Partly true, slightly exaggerated, but partly true. They started off, of course, on separate PhD projects, Simon and Derek. And Simon was given, in inverted commas, the worms, which was actually a bit of a mixed basket of organisms. Certainly the rare, the weird and the wonderful. Derek was given a project, or selected a project, that superficially looked more straightforward, the bivalved arthropods. But actually that concealed a very substantial range of variety as well. And they went about it in very different ways. They're very different individuals. There are various allusions through the book as to how closely they work together. I'm fortunate to have worked with both. I was the first postdoc of both of them. And they are very different characters. And Simon's immediate instinct, I think they both went through tens of thousands of fossils, but Simon's immediate instinct was to look for the audibles and then go ahead and publish them.
And Gould argues that many of these oddball specimens don't belong to familiar groups of animals that we know, and that they left no living descendants, and they're sort of branches of the tree of life that came to nothing in mass extinctions or something. Is that right now? I thought that had now been revised.
No, that I think is the area of the book that stands up least well in terms of modern research, because although Gould's tendency was to split organisms out, the odd organisms, into what we call phyla, the highest level of classification of animals or plants, and that really recognises different body plans. Just to say that something is a different phylum doesn't mean it's unrelated to all other organisms. There has to be an evolutionary tree in there. And I think that's what he overlooks and ignores. And now the way that we would interpret those is as what we would call stem groups. So the modern representatives of a group, such as the vertebrates, the group that I work on, we would call the crown group. That's all living representatives and their nearest fossil relatives. But prior to the acquisition of all of those morphological characteristics that we recognise modern vertebrates by, there were still vertebrates, but they just didn't have all of the morphological characteristics, and we call those stem groups. Many of the groups that Gould was recognising as new phyla are really just primitive members of existing groups. And that, I think, has been one of the biggest benefits of the book, because it drove people out to go and work out the evolutionary relationships of all of these obscure groups, and to really paint now a very full picture of the early evolution of animals and their diversification into different body plans.
Yeah, I can see why it did that, because the animals are so extraordinary. And I don't know if you had a favourite, but my favourite, of course, is the one with the wonderful name of Hallucinogenia. And that is completely fascinating, because the way it's described in the book is that it is a sort of worm-like creature that walks on stilts, or stands on stilt-like legs, with little tubules waving around above its back. But of course, we now have interpreted that in a completely different way. And those tubular things are actually its legs. And the spines are defensive spines that run along its back. And the thing that they thought originally was the head turns out to be the anus, in which there's a sort of dark stain which makes it look bigger, because however it died, it extruded stuff from the back of the animal, and the head is really quite small. And I found, because I was stimulated, I found an article in which people had looked at this under the electron microscope, and they could see the eyes and almost a mouth, which looked rather like a smile. So I think it's definitely laughing at us for the way we interpreted it initially.
Well, I think the way that group went about its research was they invented a new technique, really. When you look at these fossils, they just look as flat as a pancake, flatter than the average pancake, frankly. But they're still three-dimensional. They're very compressed. They've been collapsed flat by decay. But in between each of the layers of different parts of the body is a thin layer of clay. And that meant that with a fine dental drill, they could micro-dissect the limbs away to see what were underneath the limbs. The problem with hallucigenia was that Simon didn't quite dissect away far enough. And he had the headline story of this animal that walked on stilts and seven rows of mouths on their little tubular extensions. But he didn't dissect through. And if he had done so, he would have found a parallel row of the appendages with mouths, and they're the legs, as you say.
I love it for another reason as well, because it's supposed to be related to modern-day peripatus, which in fact doesn't live in the marine environment. It lives in damp areas in forests. And I have always loved this because it was supposed to be the missing link between the annelids and the arthropods. And I remember when I was in Puerto Rico being fortunate enough to be taken up into the forest in the middle of the island. And we found peripatus there, these little velvet worms. And I was even more excited when I saw Life in the Undergrowth by David Attenborough, in which he shows that peripatus has two sort of, they look to me like feelers, but I don't think they necessarily are. But it shoots out jets of sticky glue, which wrap up its prey so that it can eat it more easily. It's the most wonderful little creature. And your hallucigenia, when I look at it in the museum, it looks just like peripatus.
And I remember when the reinterpretation of hallucigenia came out, and there was one of those, oh, of course, moments, because it looks so much like other Burgess Shell type animals, the lobopods, we call them broadly. And velvet worms and peripatus, modern peripatus, we now know are down at the root of arthropods. You know, they're in the earliest stages of arthropodization, the development of these jointed animals.
What's your favourite?
Oh, I think it has to be Opabinia. So Opabinia was an oddball right from Walcott's day. It's this animal that has flaps down the side. It has a tail that looks a bit like some shrimp or a lobster. But at the front end, it's got the most extraordinary head that has five eyes and then a trunk that comes out of the front. And at the end of the trunk is a pincer. And it was, I think, one of the main drivers of Gould thinking, well, these things have just got to go into different animal groups. You know, they don't look like anything that's alive at the modern day. And that's true. They don't look like anything that's alive at the modern day. But actually, when you carefully analyse the morphology, the different body parts, the morphological characteristics, they sit very clearly in the root of arthropods again.
One of the things that Gould goes on a lot about is contingency, which I got a bit muddled up with. But as far as I understand it, he argues that life as we know it now is contingent on a staggeringly improbable series of events. It was all chance. And it's unpredictable and unrepeatable. The problem I had with this idea is that that's what I thought anyway. And I can't imagine how it could possibly be predictable. And I found a quote from Dawkins who said that the view he was attacking, that life marches inexorably towards a pinnacle such as man, has not been believed for over 50 years. Was he actually flogging a dead horse, so to speak?
I think he was actually simultaneously trying to flog two straw men, in a way. One was this idea of a ladder of evolution from primitive to advanced, and often illustrated by primates and, you know, the passage from chimps through to humans. And he goes on a lot in the book about that. And Dawkins is right. I mean, that had been chucked out of the window a long time ago. I think more subtly, and he does mention it specifically, he's having a go at a prevailing attitude at the time, which was that diversity was increasing inexorably from a single point origin. And that the modern world is much more diverse than the Cambrian world had been. And he didn't feel that that was true. And I think he's absolutely right about that, because now what I was saying earlier about stem groups and crown groups, we know that the modern representatives might not be there, but their primitive stem group equivalents are. And so Cambrian seafloor ecosystems would not have been markedly different. They have the same trophic structures, the same ecosystem structures as modern day ecosystems. And so I think that's much more successful as a concept, actually, that he's trying to get away from.
And the Burgess Shale is about 570 million years old or something, is it?
Well, that I made a note as I was reading, because it's a long time since I read the book. And I think that's something that's changed dramatically. The precision of radiometric dating has really, really altered. At the base of the Cambrian was thought to be 570. We now think it's about 540. You might think that 30 million years doesn't make a lot of difference, but it does. And so we now think the Burgess Shale precision has increased as well, is around 508, 509 million years ago. These other sites, Chengjiang and Sirius Passer, are about 520, and the base of the Cambrian is about 540 million years. So actually it's pushed the Burgess Shale up relative to the base of the Cambrian. It's now really quite young. It's sort of half to three quarters of the way up the Cambrian rather than right down at the origin of animals.
But in any case, this is in fact a wonderful book, I think, even though it's difficult, or I found it difficult, it's certainly worth persevering with. And it's got wonderful illustrations, and the creatures that are described are quite bizarre and extraordinary.
And that hasn't changed a lot. You know, a lot of those interpretations are intact. And it does show that the structure of Cambrian ecosystems might have been the same, but the animals that were living in them were very, very different indeed.
Yes. So let's move on. My book choice is The Beak of the Finch by Jonathan Weiner, which won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction in 1995. It's also about evolution, but rather than fossils, it's about evolution in action on a tiny volcanic island in the Galapagos. It describes the painstaking work of Peter and Rosemary Grant, who studied Darwin's famous finches for over 40 years and showed that evolution can take place in real time. Their story is interwoven with what Darwin saw and his interpretation. What did you think of it, Paul?
I hadn't read it. And I loved it. I really loved it. I'd used some of the Grant's work in my own teaching, so I knew of it. I hadn't read it in anything like so much detail. And I particularly liked it as a narrative account, because you know, sometimes one thinks that the sort of work that field biologists do is very different to the work that field geologists do. Actually, it isn't. I could relate very much to their field existence of living in a tent in the middle of nowhere. And I really liked that sort of slightly experiential aspect to their field work. And it reminded me of another author I really enjoy, Barry Lopez, who died recently, who wrote a wonderful book called Arctic Dreams that I often take with me to Greenland. And it just immerses you in that field experience.
I thought it was a brilliant description of how science is actually done, particularly field science, because there's a lot of tedious measurement, and you collect data for months and months and months, and you've really no idea what it actually all means. And you don't find that out until you analyse it much later. And if you're lucky, you find out that you've discovered something interesting and novel, but you might not. And I think it was one of his students who said something like, people think fieldwork is so romantic, but a lot of it is a real slog. And you get that from their book, because he describes how a lot of the time there, in the most ghastly weather, it's either way too hot or pouring with rain. And the island is not an easy place to work. It's tiny, for starters, and there's no food or water on it. So you have to take all your provisions with you. And it's really difficult to access. As far as I could tell, you have to be very fit, because you have to make a leap from a small dinghy onto a shelf, basically. And it must have been quite a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, tough. And to do it for year after year, decade after decade, to retrieve those data from the field. I'm not sure it's quite as inductive as collecting the data and then waiting to see what comes out of it. You know, I'm sure they were going there with hypotheses to test, but at the same time, it is a slog. I mean, I could really relate to that.
Yes, me too. Doesn't matter if you're working in a laboratory or on the field,
no,
I think.
No.
There's an awful lot of repetitive work. And in their case, what they were doing was they were studying the two of Darwin's finches which live on the island. Only two of them live there. And they focused on this one called the, the medium ground finch, which is very variable in body size and beak size and shape. And the book shows them measuring just about everything you can. So they measured the depth, the width of the beak, the colour, the weight of the bird, its leg and wing length, the seeds that it ate. They sort of went through all the seeds on the ground to see what was there. It was incredible. And then they also measured the seed hardness and size. And they have a wonderful phrase, I thought, the struggle index, which describes how tough the seeds were to crack.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's a quote in there somewhere about how Daphne Major, the island, was the perfect size because it was small enough that they could recognise every individual finch, but large enough that they could get decent numbers for their statistics.
Also, I think the other thing which was helpful was that the finches were so tame, as are all the animals in the Galapagos, but they were easy to catch, which probably isn't the case in some places that you might have studied them. And of course, the beak is a really good choice to measure because it's what the birds use to obtain their food.
And it's about the only way to identify those species, actually, because they're so recently evolved. They're very morphologically similar. You've got very similar shapes. And it's the beak that has driven evolution, as the book so nicely illustrates. And so it's the beak that we can use to identify the different species.
And the thing I found was fascinating was that Darwin thought that natural selection and evolution was a very long, drawn-out process, taking thousands of years. I guess that's what you'd probably think if you just had the fossil record to go on. But the grants showed that it can happen very quickly, even in a vertebrate, in a couple of years or less.
That's right. And actually, I thought that pairing of the Gould book with this book was perfect in that sense, because one of Gould's earlier existences had been the concept of punctuated equilibrium, this idea that species remain static in terms of their morphology for a very long time and then evolve very rapidly.
Yeah.
And this was thought to be highly improbable at the time that he proposed it with Niles Eldridge in the early 70s. But I think actually now people have come together, there is consensus that actually rapid evolution connecting different species is not such a problem. Explaining why they then don't change in morphology for long periods of time, geological time, is really the difficult thing to understand.
Ah, but I think that's what the grants also showed. I mean, the first thing they showed was, as far as I interpret it, was that actually it was the weather that was driving the change in beak size and was selecting for birds with different beak size, because it doesn't matter when there's plenty of everything. Birds which have small beaks and big beaks. I mean, this is the same species of finch. But as soon as there's competition, because there's a massive drought and there aren't enough seeds to go round, then there starts to be competition. And they found, 80% of the finches died and very few were left, and the seed bank was massively reduced. And so the birds had to concentrate on the size of the seeds which actually matched their beak. And there were more of the large seeds around, which the ones with the small beaks couldn't crack. So what you found was the birds that survived was ones with the big beaks. Mm. And then they were the ones that bred. And then next year they had, or the same year, I suppose, they had offspring which were also bigger and with bigger beaks. So there you have the natural selection.
That's right. And I suppose when one reads older popular science books, or at least in my head, I'm going for this sort of "ah, but" moment. But what about? And I suppose that we're scientists, we do that all the time. And as I read that account, I was thinking, well, that's a very good demonstration of natural selection in action, but it's not actually demonstrating speciation. And then that comes later in the book, in a perfectly constructed narrative. So I think that's right. Initially, they're showing that natural selection operates quickly, but it can easily reverse. The following years were very wet, and the large beaked forms get almost wiped out and replaced by much more utilitarian, omni-feeding small beaked birds. And so what they're showing is that the mean morphology, the mean shape of the beak is going backwards and forwards through time.
That's what's so fascinating, because of course you won't pick that up necessarily in the fossil record, and it will look as if the very long-term changes across thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, you may, because the fossil record is so poor, you may not pick any of it up.
Yeah, the two books together really made me reflect on the difference between field zoology and evolution from a zoological perspective and evolution from a paleontological perspective. And I think the biggest difficulty for all of us is that we operate on completely different timescales. The grants, we're operating on years to tens of years. Well, skip hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands. In the paleontological record, we can very rarely interpret it at much less than a million. Certainly getting down to 100,000 would be exceptional. So there's a gap then. And how do you match the two sets of data? And I think it is possible, but it requires a good knowledge on both sides of what time averaging means in the fossil record and how faunas can be interpreted in the fossil record in a way that they can't be in the zoological record.
Now, you mentioned that what we described earlier was just natural selection. You said that it wasn't a description of evolution, but they did show the evolution, speciation, a new formation of a new species, didn't they?
They did, and there's been subsequent work that it drove me to go and read some of their recent papers, actually. So the story ends in 1994. What's happened since? And a paper that I have missed when it came out was a fascinating paper from 2018 that showed migrant species of a new finch coming from a different island had settled on Daphne Major and started mating with the local females. It was a male that was the migrant, and it started mating with the local females. And within a few generations, a few years, that new species was both morphologically distinctive, genetically distinctive, and definitely a new species.
And behaviourally distinctive.
And behaviourally
distinctive.
Because
it had a different song, didn't it?
It did.
I think they mentioned that to some extent in the book, the big beak bird.
Yes, yeah, that's right. And of course, what the book didn't have in 1994 was access to whole genome analyses that we don't take for granted, but is now readily available. And I think that transforms the study of what we call morphotype or phenotype and genotype, the morphology of an animal and the genetic composition of the same animal.
Yes, so Darwin's idea is essentially confirmed.
Absolutely.
By these studies, I would say. And the other thing that they described was divergence, didn't they? Where they say what happens when island species which have been separate meet up again. His idea was that the varieties that living side by side compete with one another for the same space, and then they drive each other apart, because the individuals that that vary slightly will find a new niche in which they do better.
This idea of a wedge, I think they call it in the book. And I think the Galapagos finches and other organisms on the Galapagos are at an interesting point in their evolutionary history. The islands are new, they're volcanic islands, and so the new species have not been going for all that long. And they haven't diverged in terms of their genotype. So hybridization between different species is still very possible. And lateral gene transfer from one species to another. So it's not just genes being transferred up lineages, it's between lineages. And I think it made me realise that the Galapagos is just the perfect field laboratory for this sort of work. And you couldn't design anything better. New islands, recently speciated organisms. And I suppose it was Darwin's luck to happen upon the islands, but also his genius to recognise the utility of what he was seeing.
Mm. I think also it's pointed out later in the book that, of course, evolution is not just seen in the Galapagos. And we've known about it for a long time now because of what bacteria do, the development of resistance, and also insects. And I thought he had a very interesting comment in which he said that 50% of US citizens don't believe in evolution, but it's happening in their fields as the insects evolve resistance to crop pests.
Yeah, that's right. And we're seeing it in a really wide range of different areas as now. And it's going to be a challenge for humanity.
Yes, and he described also the evolution of a new species of fruit fly, which was unable to breed with the parent variety. I think the conclusion was really rather sad about mass extinction and how we probably won't last forever. And a very interesting comment that he made about the other species of finch that lived on the island, the cactus finch, which sometimes snap off the stigma, the female side of the cactus flower, which prevents them being pollinated and therefore any seeds being formed. So ultimately, if they carry on doing this, it's going to cause their own extinction.
Yeah, killing off their own food resources. It's a fine metaphor.
Which is, of course, to some extent, what we're busy doing at the moment.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop. My thanks to Professor Paul Smith, Director of the Oxford University Museum of Natural History. The books we have been discussing are Wonderful Life by Stephen Jay Gould, first published in 1989 and republished by Vintage Books in 2000. And The Beak of the Finch by Jonathan Weiner, published in paperback by Vintage Books in 1995. You can catch up with more suggestions for a good science read on our podcasts, which can be found on the Oxford University website. Thank you for listening.